This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a small but very select audience, and I can welcome you individually, in fact, to the National Museum of Australia. My name is Peter Stanley, and it's my very great privilege to head the museum's Centre for Historical Research. Now, it shouldn't come as any surprise to know that the National Museum is very much committed to supporting scholarship in the field of Australian studies. And to that degree, it's created a new award to supplement its existing visiting fellowships. That new award is called the Director's Fellowship. Each quarter, the museum awards a fellowship that will enable the foremost practitioners in disciplines across the museum's themes to visit Canberra to continue research, consultation with colleagues, and to speak about their work. My only regret tonight is that our director, Craddock Morton, who has taken a very strong interest in the research work of the museum and the Centre for Historical Research, Craddock is unable to be with us tonight because he's on his way to New York to be present at an exhibition opening. So it falls to me to tell you that the first of the director's fellowships has been awarded to Professor David Day, who, of course, is a noted historian of Australia, who's occupied many academic positions in Australia and overseas, and he's recently been Professor of Australian Studies at the Centre for Pacific and American Studies at the University of Tokyo. But for me, one of the hallmarks of David's career is that he's worked always as a freelancer rather than as a tenured historian, and the museum and the centre is especially keen to support productive, independent scholars, and David is a very notable example of that genus. David's published many books in Australian history, and they've won prizes and gained wide recognition. His books include his analysis of Australian and Allied politics during the Second World War, Menzies and Churchill at War, The Great Betrayal, and Reluctant Nation. He's published biographies of John Curtin and Ben Chifley, A General History of Australia, which I notice is on sale at the table outside, Claiming a Continent, and on an even broader scale, he's published a book, Conquest, A New History of the Modern World. His next book, the book after the one he'll talk about tonight, is The Weather Watchers, a centenary history of the Australian Bureau of Meteorology, and that'll be published soon. Now, I don't say I've always agreed with David, but I greatly respect his gifts as an historian, and I and the museum are proud to be associated with such a productive scholar who's made contributions to our understanding of Australia's past and its relationship to the world. So we're very pleased to be able to be furthering that work. This evening, though, we can look forward to hearing David speak about his current research project on Australia's first Labor Prime Minister, the Queenslander Andrew Fisher, a subject which, though over 90 years old, has strangely topical resonance for us today. So I'll invite David to come and speak about Andrew Fisher. Thanks, David.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, for that kind introduction. I thought I'd start with this cartoon, I guess, of Andrew Fisher to show how dapper he was. He was, I think, the most handsome of our Australian Prime Ministers, even taking into account the present one. But for all that, he's been largely forgotten. If you asked somebody in the street, you know, you'd be hard put to get them to say that they remembered or knew who Andrew Fisher was. And yet he was Prime Minister three times, 1908 to 1909, from 1910 to 1913, and 1914 to 15. He was the Prime Minister, after all, who took Australia into the First World War, who took Australia to Gallipoli. And then went on to London as High Commissioner to sit on the Dardanelles Commission to investigate why the Dardanelles operation went so wrong. So what I want to do today then is to bring Fisher back to life, if that's possible, to try and understand why Fisher has been neglected by historians up till now, to look to some extent at the origins of his politics in Scotland and in Queensland, to assess to some extent his importance and his achievements, and to wonder why it was that he resigned in 1915 and let in Billy Hughes with all the terrible things that came after under Hughes's prime ministership. Well, when people look back on the First World War, they mostly think of Billy Hughes, who tore the party and the country apart over conscription, not once but twice. And if they're particularly well-informed, they might also think of the first Labour Prime Minister, Chris Watson, and perhaps, only perhaps, his successor, Andrew Fisher. If he's remembered at all, Fisher is best known for his commitment to Britain in the First World War to support Britain to the last man and the last shilling, hence the title of the talk. And that's about it as far as public memory goes. Yet he was Prime Minister, as I said, three times, for a total period of just less than 5 years, making him the eighth longest-serving Prime Minister in Australia out of 25. As far as Labour Prime Ministers go, he served longer than either Scullin, Curtin, Chifley, Whitlam or Keating, and served for about the same time as Deakin on the Conservative side. It is Deakin, though, who is much more remembered and indeed revered. Well, why has Fisher been overlooked? Well, partly it was because he was judged so harshly by his contemporaries, and people looked back at Fisher through the eyes of his contemporaries, through the eyes of Hughes and through the eyes of Deakin. Hughes was particularly critical of Fisher, describing the Labour Party's choice of Fisher in 1907 rather, choice of Fisher as leader of the Labour Party, as choosing the safe man rather than the brilliant man. He, of course, was the brilliant man that was overlooked. And that has been taken up by historians ever since. In 1964, Hughes's biographer described Fisher as a man of no great intellectual or oratorical gifts, although adding that he radiated solidity and trustworthiness, which one might have thought were greater assets to a politician. The following year, the biographer of Alfred Deakin described Fisher as tall and unusually handsome, but a slow thinker, shrewd in his own careful way, not without vanity, a man of integrity, whose public reputation and place in his party depended on his rock-like lack of brilliance. Well, this tendency by historians to push Fisher into the shadows was also due to him slipping into the shadows himself. He spent the last 13 years of his life in London, five of them as High Commissioner, during which time he was effectively ignored by Hughes and robbed of any real responsibility. In many ways, Keith Murdoch played the part of High Commissioner much more than Fisher did. The manner of Fisher's mental decline and dying of dementia in 1928 has also perhaps affected the way historians have looked at his earlier life. Indeed, some have suggested he was suffering from the effects of dementia as early as 1914 in the wake of his election win. This is most unlikely given the things that he did in 1915 and even in 1916 sitting on the Dardanelles Commission. Well, Fisher has not only been relatively neglected by historians but also tends to be underrated. For one thing, he was not the first Labour Prime Minister. That honour, of course, went to Chris Watson, albeit his minority government only lasting a few months and achieving nothing. Despite this, it was Watson's government rather than Fisher's that was recently made the subject of a book by Labour historian Ross McMullen. It certainly helps to be first. Fisher's time in office also came after the immediate post-Federation years and before the big conscription crises of 1916 and 17 and the political tumult that they introduced into Australian politics. They were years when you could be forgiven for thinking that not much happened, which may explain why biographers were slow to tackle a study of Fisher. Their lack of interest may also have been due to Fisher living for the last 13 years of his life in London and his papers, most importantly, remaining in London until the 1960s when they were finally given by his family to the National Library. This, once they'd been given to the National Library, finally removed a substantial hurdle that would have had to be surmounted by any potential biographer. So this explains then why there's been no major scholarly biography written about Fisher. It was not until perhaps the 1970s, more than 50 years after Fisher's retirement, that the Queensland historian Dennis Murphy began researching what would have been a major biography of Fisher. Well, tragically, that book never appeared. After Murphy was diverted into politics when he was elected to the Queensland Parliament and was then tragically struck down by cancer in his late 40s in 1984. So all we've been left to go on with from Dennis have been a few articles and the entry on Fisher in the ADB. Murphy's notes, though, in the Fryer Library in Brisbane show that we missed out on getting what would have been a well-researched and insightful study of Fisher. And my own work has benefited greatly from Murphy's work. 15 years after Murphy's death, the task of writing Fisher's biography was taken up by Clem Lloyd, who was granted funds for that purpose as part of the Centenary of Federation celebrations. But that too ended tragically when Clem died suddenly in the midst of completing the work on New Year's Eve in 2001. And we are left with just a brief 13-page chapter that Clem wrote for Michelle Grattan's book, Australian Prime Ministers. In that chapter, Clem gives some sign of how he was planning to approach the biography, mounting a stout defence of Fisher against his detractors. So here we are. It's a centenary after Fisher's first government in 1908, or it will be next year. And all we have to go on are those few traces from these two attempted biographies, and a slim book by John Murdoch, which was published in 1998 by what I just found out yesterday was a vanity publisher in the United Kingdom, which stretches to little more than 100 pages. It's almost impossible to get a copy of that book in Australia. There is no copy, apparently, as far as I could tell, in the National Library, although there is one in the ANU Library. It was based on an MA that Murdoch did on Australian liberalism in the period 1906 to 1914 at the University of Western Australia. It doesn't do Fisher justice, not by a long way, either in the attention it accords him or the assessment that it makes of him. And it really is extraordinary that this is the most substantial work that we have on Fisher. Even hopeless American presidents have multiple biographies written about them. The more hopeless, the more biographies, it seems to be. Well, how did a man then who began as a coal miner in Scotland become one of the great, what I would call one of the great nation-building prime ministers of Australia? Well, the usual approach with Fisher is to fit him into the log cabin to White House genre, with Fisher being the son of a coal miner who sent down the mines at the age of 9 when his father is stricken with the coal miner's curse, black lung disease. Forced to support his family, Fisher then becomes involved in the union, is blacklisted for his militancy, and is forced to immigrate to Australia. Landing in Queensland in 1885, he again becomes involved with the labour movement, is again blacklisted, but nevertheless rises within 23 years to become Prime Minister of Australia. Well, there was a certain amount of truth in this brief outline of his life. He certainly was the second son of a coal miner, and he did work down the mines at a young age. just exactly what the age was still remains a matter of some dispute. Writers put it anywhere between the age of 9 and the age of 13. He was born in the mining village of Crosshouse in Ayrshire, just north of, west of Kilmarnock, rather. But when he began work remains, well, I've not been able to settle even in my own mind when it was. Fisher, though, seems to confirm that it may have been at the age of 13. There was an interview that he did in 1910 that he had a chance to correct after it was written up, and the interviewer had listed him going down the mines at 13, and Fisher made no alteration to that, although he did alter various other facts. But at other times, he seems to give different ages, so it's very difficult to know. It is possible, as a Scottish historian pointed out to me, that he may have in fact gone down the mine at 9, and then when the Education Act came in 1872, which required him to be at school until the age of 12, that he in fact was forced to leave the mine and go back to school. He may also have talked about going down the mine at the age of 9 in the sense that he took his brother's or his father's lunch down the mine, because mines in Ayrshire were not the sort of mines that we usually think of. They were quite small, with perhaps only 20 workers and not very deep. So it's quite feasible for a child, say, to go the half a kilometre or so from the village with food or whatever for their family. As for his father, if he was suffering from a terminal disease, as most writers have it, in the early 1870s, which supposedly forced Fisher down the mines, well, he was still alive in 1885 when Fisher emigrated to Australia and didn't die until 1887, perhaps 15 years after leaving the mines. Moreover, rather than being a chronic invalid, incapable of work, he joined with other miners to form a local cooperative, acted as its secretary, and served in its store. He also apparently kept bees as an additional source of income, and shortly before Fisher's immigration, did work on a farm as a contractor with his son. He was a man with ambitions for himself, his children, and his fellow miners. Respectability, honour, and duty were all important for the Fisher family. As this photograph shows. This was taken after Fisher left for Queensland and shows his father and mother and his remaining siblings. Fisher went out to Queensland with his younger brother. So that's obviously his father, second from the left there. In presumably 1885, a couple of years before he died. The Fisher family believed that hard, honest work should be rewarded and that there was no shame in enjoying those rewards. They were working class who aspired to something better. In the parlance of today, they were aspirational. And like so many of their fellow Scots, they would try to achieve their aspirations through education. For Andrew Fisher, it meant attending two or three different village schools during his childhood, where he received a fair education for the times. And once he began work as a coal miner, he supplemented this education with night classes in Kilmarnock. These classes were mainly of a practical nature to allow him to take on supervisory jobs in the mines. And after he moved to Queensland, he not only kept up his own education and self-improvement, but sent money back to Scotland to finance the education of his younger brother. Well, it was also the education from his parents that was important in forming the worldview of young Andrew Fisher. Informed by their stories, he believed that he was not just any Scot, but a descendant of the Scottish rebel William Wallace, whose first deeds of resistance were performed near Fisher's birthplace. Fisher took inspiration from Wallace and also from Scotland's poet Robert Burns. When Fisher actually went to Aberdeen later in 1911, he took his son up to Aberdeen and transcribed a notation from a statue of Wallace, inspiring people to stand up for their independence. He was also inspired by the work of Robert Burns, whose first book was published in Kilmarnock in 1786. Not long before Fisher left for Queensland, Kilmarnock saw its biggest ever demonstration when a statue and commemorative museum and tower was unveiled in his honour. It was the radicalism as much as the Scottish nationalism that Fisher took from the works of Burns, and he memorised much of Burns's poetry. He was particularly fond of citing Burns's idealistic song, which looked forward to a time when men the world over will brothers be. The influence of the Free Presbyterian Church was also important in forming Fisher's political views. The church had been a traditional site of protest within Scottish society, with its instances of martyrdom being a source of continuing inspiration to those confronted by oppression. The democratic government of the church was also an inspiration to those who wanted an extension of such democracy to the political sphere. For Fisher, democracy became an end in itself. He believed that the universal adult franchise would open the door to socialism, that once workers could vote, their numbers would ensure control of Parliament and the gradual implementation, not in his lifetime, but eventually, in the fullness of time, the gradual implementation of socialist measures and of socialism itself. Fisher's politics was also influenced by his experience with the trade union movement in Scotland and later in Queensland. As a local official of the Ayrshire Miners' Union, he stood beside Keir Hardie, one of the founders of the British Labour Party, and became secretary of the union's Crosshouse branch. But the prolonged strike in which he became involved saw the miners suffer great hardship for little reward. The union was smashed and Fisher was twice blacklisted. The Australian strikes of the 1890s ended similarly. It made Fisher cautious about using the strike weapon and committed him instead to the parliamentary path. Well, like most British workers in the 1880s, Fisher looked to Gladstone's Liberal Party to advance the political interests of the workers with social reforms, industrial legislation, and most importantly, an extension of the franchise. In Crosshouse in 1884, it was Fisher who led the local campaign to support Gladstone's plan to broaden the franchise in the face of staunch opposition from the House of Lords. And he wrote to Gladstone afterwards, telling him of the support in Crosshouse and the surrounding area for an extension of the franchise. With the British Labour Party many years from being formed, Fisher's politics then came from Scottish liberalism and didn't owe much, if anything, to socialist tracts. It was imbued with these ideas that Fisher left Scotland for Queensland in 1885, with his father's parting wish, wishing him every success in honest industry. Well, for Fisher, Queensland was a new land with new opportunities. Well, that was how, at least how he saw it. He found work on the Burram Gulf coalfield near Hervey Bay, and was soon promoted to manage one of the small coal mines. He bought land and built himself a cottage, something that would have been inconceivable in Scotland. Just 2 years after landing in Queensland, he'd become a man of property. It truly was a land of opportunity in which honest industry would receive its just reward. But then his life soured when he failed to get a job as mine manager and a lesser qualified man was appointed in his place. Well, getting that job may well have seen Fisher not being drawn into politics. He may have become instead, you know, a local identity around Hervey Bay. Instead, he shifted from the Burram field to the much larger Gympie goldfield. And this became his political base for the next 25 years. Well, there was much to draw Fisher into politics. Queensland was a colony with a franchise that was as restricted as that in Scotland and was notorious among the Australian colonies for the rorts that kept many Queensland workers from voting. For instance, you know, shearers and miners, people on the move, were unable to vote because they weren't resident in the one place for months before an election. Moreover, it was a colony which was divided between those wanting it to be the exclusive preserve of white people and those who believed that tropical Australia could only be developed with the use of indentured labour from Asia. So Gympie then becomes Fisher's base. And this is a photo looking up towards Red Hill, which is the centre of Presbyterian Gympie. Gympie was supposedly likened by some of its residents to Rome because it was supposedly set on seven hills. And one of the hills was Red Hill. And if you look up in the right-hand corner, the large building in the very right-hand corner is the Presbyterian Church, which became one of the centres of Fisher's life in Gympie. He later noted that he'd left the Burram field because it was mentally impoverishing. It was, you know, a small community with very little of the civilised amenities of life. You know, the libraries, the learned societies, the debating societies and such forth, the things that he was used to in Kilmarnock that weren't there in Burram, but were there in Gympie. And Fisher himself did much to promote those societies. He quickly became involved in many of the town's institutions, from the Presbyterian Church, becoming a Sunday school teacher, to the Debating Society, the Chess Club, the local cooperative, the Friendly Society, the School of Arts, the Miners' Union, and the forerunner of the Labour Party. He even joined the local volunteer force, but gave it up when on the first outing it ended up in unbridled drinking, and Fisher was a committed teetotal throughout his life. Well, although it was a town seemingly divided along ethnic and religious lines, you know, there was the Presbyterian Hill, the Methodist Hill, the Catholic Hill, the Anglican Hill with their church on each of them. Nevertheless, there was great mixing between those religious and ethnic groups. So, for instance, if the Catholic Church had an event on, everybody went. So it wasn't just the Catholics going to the local Catholic church. Everybody went along and contributed. So Fisher later noted when he went to England that, in fact, there was no racism in Australia, that we all got on together, the Welsh and the Irish and the Scots and the English. The economic divisions were also not as deep as they might have seemed. Many of the miners were shareholders and sometimes even directors of the mines in which they worked. Fisher himself soon removed himself from the dangers of the mine shaft and found employment on the surface as an engine driver. In other words, operating the stationary engine that sent the miners down the shaft and brought the ore up. He also bought shares in some of the mines, although it's difficult to know from his papers in the National Library exactly how successful he was with his investments. One suspects that he wasn't all that successful. He was certainly very conservative in his later investments. Once he'd become Prime Minister, there were no mining shares at all in his later investments. It was all government bonds and sewerage works. So rather than concealing his shareholdings, it wasn't a matter of shame to Fisher, despite being a member of the labour movement, to have shares. This was a common thing. In fact, he celebrated the fact that he was a shareholder and made much of it in his election campaigns, telling people, you know, what he was doing was in fact telling them the investment that he had in Gympie, that he had more than £100 invested in the success of the Gympie mines, and therefore he deserved to be their local member. At one stage, he was even criticised by a Conservative opponent for overstating his shareholdings. Somebody who'd actually audited the local mines' shareholdings and said that he hadn't come across Fisher's name all that often and disputed whether, in fact, Fisher had as many shares as he claimed to have. Similarly, when he established a Labour newspaper in Gympie in 1896, although there were occasional mentions of Karl Marx, well, at least one that I saw, 2 pages of the newspaper every week were devoted to mining news. That is, how much gold was dug up, how much the shares were worth on the local stock exchange in Gympie. So, not surprisingly then, Fisher's socialism, as a result of both his experience in Scotland and of the particular experience of Gympie, was of the most moderate kind, as was that of most of his Labour colleagues, elected to the Queensland Parliament along with Fisher in 1893. There was little to distinguish their platform from that of their radical Liberal opponents. But Fisher was adamant that they shouldn't join with these radical Liberals in any suggested coalition, but maintain their separate identity and build up the Labour Party as a separate organisation. And the main way of distinguishing Labour from the Liberals was on the question of White Australia and the use of indentured labour from the Pacific Islands in the sugar industry. In a letter to electors in 1899, Fisher talked of workers' compensation schemes, old age pensions, and low interest government loans. But he particularly promised to secure the exclusion of inferior races from Queensland. Of the 14 reasons that he listed for voting against the government, 5 concerned the government's support for non-European labour, with Fisher's letter claiming that the government was threatening the very existence of the white race. And it was the Japanese that particularly concerned Fisher, who claimed that the Japs are swarming into Queensland, entering into competition with white workers and establishing their filthy dens of immorality in all our towns. Now, Fisher's view of the Japanese was probably coloured by the manner of his arrival in Australia. He came on a new shipping line that was designed to bring immigrants, particularly to Queensland. So it came by way of the Torres Strait, and its first landing spot was Thursday Island, which had a particularly strong population of Japanese working in the pearl fishery. So his first sight of Australia then would be Thursday Island, which I think at that time had a majority of Japanese people living there. So Fisher's appeals to racial fears were a repeated vote winner, both for him and for the Labour Party, helping to deflect Conservative allegations about Labour being in the grip of the trade unions, which has got a familiar ring to it somehow. And when Labour MPs sat down in 1901 to draw up their fighting platform, just 5 issues were listed: White Australia, adult suffrage, old age pensions, a citizen army, and compulsory arbitration. It was, after all, the party of pragmatic reformists. They looked forward to a better world, but they were content to achieve it gradually, step by step, and were committed to confine its benefits just to white Australians. Well, Fisher's fear of Japan was heightened after the stunning Japanese naval victory over Russia in 1905, and the effective admission by Britain, with its Anglo-Japanese alliance, that its fleet, the British fleet, could no longer defend Australia. Fisher realised that Australia would have to do more to defend itself, and many of his policies as Prime Minister were directed towards that purpose, whether it was creating an Australian Navy or imposing a land tax to encourage the settlement of the interior, introducing a maternity allowance to cut the white infant death rate, or constructing a railway to connect Western Australia to the eastern states. It was all about securing the effective possession of the continent before it was contested by the Japanese. But with less than 5 million people occupying the continent, Australians had little hope of defending the place by themselves. Hence the attachment by Fisher to the idea of imperial defence, despite his doubts about England's capacity to make good on its promises. It was this fear of Japan that prompted Fisher and his colleagues in 1911 to pledge support for Britain in the coming European War, and for Fisher to repeat that pledge 3 years later with his memorable commitment to support Britain to the last man and the last shilling, a pledge that would set the stage for conscription despite Fisher's personal opposition to compulsion. Well, it's clear from the work that I've done, and I'm sort of about two-thirds of the way through writing the book, and thanks to the museum have now had a chance to finish off the research. It's clear from what I've done and the work of Clem Lloyd and Dennis Murphy that Andrew Fisher was denigrated unfairly by some of his influential contemporaries and has, as a consequence, been underrated by historians. And when considering Fisher, several things need to be remembered. Firstly, he was Prime Minister far longer than either Edmund Barton or George Reid. Although Deakin and Fisher were Prime Ministers for about the same length of time, Fisher achieved so much more. His government passed 113 pieces of legislation in his first 3 years in power, from 1910 to 13, during which time he also spent several months in South Africa in 1910 and Britain in 1911. Well, Fisher was not only important to Australian history, but to international history. He was a minister in the Dawson Labor government in Queensland in 1899, which has been claimed as the world's first socialist government, even though it was the government of a colony and lasted just 6 days and obviously did nothing in that time. He went on to be a minister in Watson's Labor government in 1904, which was the first time that a professedly socialist government had taken charge of a nation, although again it lasted only a few months and was unable to implement any of its socialist policies. He was then Prime Minister of a minority government in 1908-09 before becoming leader of the world's first government in which a socialist party had control of both houses of parliament. And we've seen over the last few years what you can do with control of both houses of parliament. It allowed the possibility of socialism by legislation, and the world watched, partly with horror on the part of some and partly with admiration on the part of others. He was not only Prime Minister, but also served each time as Treasurer, a feat that was later repeated by Ben Chifley. Well, with his handsome demeanour and palpable honesty, Fisher did much to make the Labor Party respectable, and make it difficult for conservatives to portray the party as a bunch of dangerous revolutionaries. And this, I think, is one of Fisher's main achievements during this time. He was, in the parlance of today, a fiscal conservative. He opposed borrowing for unproductive purposes. When Deakin tried to get a loan to pay for the Australian Navy, Fisher came in as Prime Minister soon after, cancelled the loan and paid for the Navy out of government revenue. Some of his major initiatives as Prime Minister were the establishment of the Commonwealth Bank, the Australian Navy, the Australian Capital Territory, the takeover and attempted development of the Northern Territory, the building of the Transcontinental Railway, a land tax to promote more intensive development of the interior, universal military training, the officer school at Duntroon, government munition factories, old age and invalid pensions, and maternity allowances, the Australian note issue, and many more. It was all about securing the continent for the nation, for the white Australian nation. Well, whereas Watson had trouble keeping the caucus together and Hughes split the party in the country, Fisher managed by the quiet force of his personality and his astute handling of political allies to maintain good relations and a fair degree of control over such difficult colleagues as Billy Hughes and King O'Malley. Whereas Deakin led his Liberals to a state of terminal decline, finally smothering the party when he embraced his more conservative opponents in the fusion government of 1909, Fisher led the Labor Party to one of its greatest electoral victories in 1910, presiding over Australia's first majority government. He did what Deakin, Barton, Reid had all aspired to do. He actually had a majority in the parliament and was able to rule in his own right. And remember, this was 35 years before the Labor Party managed to do likewise in Britain. Well, Fisher did it not only once, but repeated the feat in 1914. This time doing it against the backdrop of the First World War, when the Conservatives had been confident of winning power. Now, while he was not a great speaker, being partially deaf and having a thick Ayrshire accent, which became thicker as he got more excited in debate, he was nevertheless an effective parliamentary debater, and on the hustings managed to overcome his deficiencies by teaming up with the witty and almost completely blind senator, Gregor MacGregor from South Australia, who was also important as leader of the Labor Party in the Senate in keeping the caucus loyal to Fisher. And this is Gregor sitting down on the far left, a fellow who was supposedly also teetotal, although I saw a report of one meeting in Mount Gambier where he demanded champagne, claiming, supposedly, in the ADB entry, it says that he was teetotal, but in the report that I read, in fact, he was teetotal one year and then not the next. And this was supposedly his teetotal year when he was in Mount Gambier, but he claimed that champagne was not really liquor, that it wasn't only whiskey counted as alcohol, and he could be teetotal and drink champagne. Well, again, while Deakin has been rightly described as a father of federation, Fisher was just as passionate about federation, and as Prime Minister probably did more than Deakin to break down state loyalties and imbue the former colonists with a sense of being Australian. And he did it against considerable resistance from the state premiers. And I was looking just in the last week or so in the National Library in his papers, and there's a Christmas card from the Queensland Premier. Nothing remarkable about that, you might think. But you should see this Christmas card. It stretches this far. It is leather-bound, a leather-bound Christmas card with a huge photograph in the middle of the Queensland Ministry, and on one side, in great scrolling writing, to the Prime Minister of the Commonwealth, and on the other side, from the Prime Minister of Queensland. So Fisher did what he could to break down those sort of alternative loyalties and to put these premiers or putative prime ministers in their place. Well, the great tragedy, of course, of Fisher's political life was to have his work as a nation-building prime minister culminate in the gullies of Gallipoli, and then to see the party he had done so much to build up be torn apart within a year of his resignation. Well, turning then to that decision by Fisher to resign in October 1915 and hand the prime ministership to Billy Hughes, from which so much flowed. Well, it's usually said that he resigned for health reasons, and there is probably something in that. It's said that he went off to New Zealand at the end of 1914 because he simply couldn't cope with the strain of the war. But in fact, if you look in his papers, he didn't have a holiday in New Zealand. He had a huge and continual round of meetings, public meetings and official meetings with the New Zealand government, trying to get the New Zealand government to bring its navy into line with the Australian navy. It was anything but a holiday. There were other reasons that were impelling Fisher to resign at this time. For one thing, he feared that he might be forced, like Churchill had been in Britain, to pay the political cost of Gallipoli. And it really is quite extraordinary that nobody in Australia, no politician in Australia, paid the political cost, paid any cost for Gallipoli. But there was mounting criticism. Gallipoli was coming to a crisis. It was either going to be overrun by the Turks in the Christmas, in the winter of 1915, or there was going to be a disastrous withdrawal from Gallipoli. Nobody predicted that the withdrawal would be successful. The British government was calculating on, I think, about a third or so of casualties, so a third being killed in the attempted withdrawal from Gallipoli. So by resigning, and not only resigning, but swapping jobs by taking on the High Commissionership in London, Fisher would avoid paying the price of Gallipoli. He would also avoid having to deal with the conscription issue. There was growing pressure in Australia from the conservative side of politics, but also from the Labor side, to introduce conscription, to keep up the numbers for the front, which had expanded considerably in the wake of Gallipoli, but were now beginning to trail off. Fisher's promise to give Britain to the last man and the last shilling committed Australia morally to help Britain, and if people didn't come voluntarily, to introduce conscription to ensure that that promise was upheld. So Fisher, though, in principle, was opposed to conscription. And by resigning when he did, he would avoid having to deal with this and avoid the problem of trying to hold the Labor Party together, because most of them also sided with him rather than with Hughes and the pro-conscription lobby. Well, there were also other reasons. There were financial reasons. This is Fisher's house in Melbourne that he took over. I think it was just after he became Labor leader. He bought the land and built the house himself. I went through the house just a couple of weeks ago. It's a house, quite a substantial house, quite a valuable house in Melbourne, in Albert Park, just a couple of blocks from the beach. It's got three bedrooms, living room, dining room, and a very small backyard. In that house were Fisher, six children, his mother-in-law, and either two or three sister-in-laws. Looking at it, I still don't see how they managed to fit in there. So Fisher moved up, buying this huge mansion in East St. Kilda, a mansion that was so big that when Billy Hughes visited, he gave Fisher a compass to find his way around the house after locking up the windows and the doors at night, so he could find his way back to the bedroom. Fisher not only bought the house, but an acre or so of land around it that was going to be sold separately. Instead, he had it tossed in and bought the lot, and then had a cow shipped down from Queensland, which he put out the back, and his wife and sister-in-laws used to milk. So suddenly he was burdened with these huge debts. He retained the Elbert Park house and bought this borrowed money to buy this huge mansion. Had he lost his job as Prime Minister, he would have been ruined. He would have been forced to sell the house and perhaps squash himself back into the much smaller Elbert Park abode. So resigning and going to London on a salary that was 50% higher than that of the Prime Minister ensured that at least for the next 5 years he would have security. And he tried also, when going to London, to rent out this house to the Defence Department as a hospital for wounded soldiers. But unfortunately for Fisher, they declined to take it on because they'd already had so many offers of other large houses. So instead, his sister-in-laws remained living in the house. Fisher would also have been mindful in resigning that he would be postponing his death from overwork. He had lost three cabinet ministers to sudden death. Three cabinet ministers from 1910 had died by 1915. More importantly, he'd lost Gregor MacGregor, who died on the 13th of August 1914. So he no longer had MacGregor to stand alongside him on political platforms, and perhaps more importantly, guard his back from scheming caucus members. And lastly, perhaps he was sensing the first signs of dementia, the dementia that he would have recognised in his political opponent, Alfred Deakin, creeping up on Deakin from about 1909, and which had forced Deakin to resign in 1913. It was the dementia that would slowly rob Fisher of his mental faculties and eventually, of course, of his life. Well, could he have held the party together and withstood the clamour for conscription? It's doubtful. After all, it was a clamour that he would have found hard to resist, and had, as I explained, to some extent, unintentionally inspired, having committed Australia to support Britain to the last man. For a myriad of reasons, it would have seemed better to Fisher that he should leave the political scene when he did, even if his passing should usher in Hughes and all that meant for the Labour Party and the nation. Well, like Hughes, Fisher's prime ministership has been seen through the prism of the war, as if his last man commitment effectively summed up his time at the top. Well, as I've tried to explain, his importance went much further than that. Internationally, as this postcard shows, the example of his success and his political moderation was important in encouraging the leaders of the British Labour Party, as well as democratic socialists in other countries, much to the chagrin of Lenin, who famously dismissed Fisher's government in 1913 as being of no relevance to European socialists. When Fisher, though, went to Europe 2 years earlier, he was greeted in Paris by French socialists and met in London by Keir Hardie, Ramsay MacDonald, and other leading Labour figures, with Hardie later accompanying Fisher to Ayrshire and then taking him on a tour of the Welsh coalfields. In Australia, he should be regarded as more of a nation builder, I would argue, than Deakin. What Deakin mainly talked about or recoiled from doing, Fisher did. Although his contribution was not always positive, a reassessment of his place in Australia's early history is long overdue. Thank you.
Well, David, successful biographers, I think, have to like their subjects. And I think you've given us a strong case for why we should think better of Andrew Fisher. There is, after all, no Fisher University, is there?
No.
He's a deacon. But I think you're a brave man, given the fate of Dennis Murphy and Lloyd. Do not fear the curse of Andrew Fisher.
That's why I'm working so fast. Yes.
And I should say, too, that tonight's talk will not just be available to the privileged few who've heard it here, but in fact it will be available in due course on the museum's website. So Elise has a microphone, so if I can invite you to ask questions.
The colonies were vying for immigrants. Have you got any sense of why he ended up going to Queensland?
It was, as far as one can tell, due to the connections with Ayrshire. There were other Ayrshire people in Queensland, so when he arrived in Queensland, he went up and connected with other Ayrshire people on the Burram coalfield. And as well, there'd been Ayrshire people, McIlwraith, the Queensland Premier, who was an Ayrshire man, who'd come out to Kilmarnock and given a talk in Kilmarnock just prior to this, encouraging people of Kilmarnock to come out to Queensland. So there was a lot of publicity about Queensland. There were advertisements about Queensland, and there was a local recruiter for the Queensland government in Ayrshire, close by Kilmarnock, from what I can recall.
Thanks very much, David. That's an intriguing... Pardon? Is that better? An intriguing account. I have very mixed feelings about Fisher. On the one hand, and I'm going to get you to comment on what I'm saying, on the one hand, he seemed to have such a lot of idealism and integrity, and yet on the other hand, he was, well, we would say today, racist, and perhaps not all that realistically about, with regard to the Japanese. I know that was a compelling fear driving a lot of politicians in early federal days. And also, of course, he was perhaps just through sheer lack of insight. He had no idea what was, as did very few people have any idea as to what was going to be the outcome in World War I, for not just for Australians, but for the British themselves, the French, the Germans, Russians, and so on. So, and I'm sort of wondering whether one doesn't describe him as a tragic figure and somebody who's wanted to be a nation builder, but who tragically failed. And we still haven't become of age as a nation, one might well argue.
Yes. Well, you know, it's hard to, for us today to perhaps recognise it, but white Australia did have an incredibly strong strand of idealism running through it. People were very conscious that what they saw as an empty country, for the first time, had a population drawn from one particular race. And so they saw Australia as being able to create for itself a modern, progressive, relatively egalitarian society, free from all those conflicts of Europe, but also different from the new society of the United States, free from those racial antagonisms that bedeviled the United States and led to the Civil War. So what Fisher feared from the influx of non-Europeans into Australia was that the north of Australia would end up being like the south of the United States, and that there would end up being a civil war in Australia. So, you know, there was racism in the support, both by Fisher and by other people. He tended not to be as rabid as some of his supporters. You know, Henry Boot, who actually edited the Gympie Truth, the newspaper that Fisher owned, was quite rabid in his support for white Australia. Fisher, in what you can tell from the accounts of his speeches, was not so rabid. Although some of the justifications for white Australia that Fisher used were racial ones. You know, things about maintaining the purity of the British race, and the idea of Australia not being a mongrel race were words that he used. So it's not really what I'm trying to say, I guess, is it's not in conflict with Fisher the idealist. He's seeing white Australia in idealistic terms.
I'm reminded, David, of these comments of Xavier Herbert, a significant Australian, who used to bemoan the fact that we never became what we could have become, a Creole nation, which is interesting. Mm. And it's interesting, Xavier used to, we had him at the ANU, Xavier used to blame Billy Hughes for most of the ills of life. And he had known him. I thought the beautiful cartoon at the beginning, reminiscent of the not very attractive portrait of Keating in Old Parliament House.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Yes. Just had that kind of... look, this is unpleasant, but I'm probably way off the mark, but this business of dementia that so many people, about 100 years ago, one wonders sometimes about sexual... diseases. Am I way off?
You're way off the mark.
In these cases, I'm way off the mark.
Yes.
The cases you're mentioning.
Syphilis often ended up in dementia, but it was it ended up, you know, might last a year or two. With Fisher, it was at least 8 or 10 years. So it was early onset dementia. Deacon as well, yes.
What drew you personally to the subject of Fisher?
Well, I mean, it partly flowed on from the biographies of Curtin and Chifley. I mean, it was a bit ironic, really. I took it on without realising that Clem Lloyd had already done so. He'd done so either the same year or perhaps the year earlier, had begun work on it, and I hadn't realised. So that could have been interesting. We might have had suddenly two biographies of Fisher instead of one. But it's partly, I've always been fascinated by that period in Australian history, and particularly why Australia was so gung-ho about its entry into the First World War. As a student, you know, as a history undergrad at Melbourne Uni, I'd done work on the labour movement in Victoria and looked at, you know, the very strong anti-war feelings in the labour movement and how that simply was swept away in August 1914. Even though some people held true to their ideals, people like John Kane and John Curtin were anti-war right through. But most of the other people in the labour movement, in the Socialist Party and whatever, tended to put those views aside and fall in with Britain. So I was interested in looking at the period and doing it by way of a biography, because a history of the period, perhaps 10 people will read, a biography of Fisher, perhaps hopefully 10,000 people will read.
David, thank you for giving so generously of your time, not just tonight, but in the work you've done to make this biography a reality. And when it appears next August, published by
HarperCollins,
there will be 10,000 copies in bookshops all over Australia. and people will read it. We know that because they've got a capacity to sell books. But also people will listen to your talk on the museum's website, and that will enlighten us in a much more concise way. And I must say, speaking as somebody who, to be honest, always found pre-First World War Australian politics a bit on the dull side, there was never a dull moment in your account of it, so I must have just been reading the wrong books, or ignoring the wrong books, perhaps. So thank you very much for being associated with the museum, and we look forward to further warm collaboration. And thanks particularly to Elise Murphy for organising tonight's talk, and our technical friends from Media Operations. And thank you very much for coming to the museum tonight on a rather dreary but welcomely wet night. And we'll see you at another talk organised by the museum. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.